This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suohib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Lessons learned from other countries have shown that investigative commissions can contribute to transitional societies in assessing truth about human rights violations, ensuring accountability, serving justice, and achieving guarantee of non-recurrence or non-repetition.
That's Aristide Nononsi, the UN independent expert on Sudan, on the need to create an independent, impartial commission to investigate human rights violations in that country. Details coming up also. Today is World Contraception Day, a global campaign focused on improving awareness among young people on making informed choices on sexual and reproductive health. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, a Harare court has upheld an earlier ruling that the head of the doctors' union can travel to South Africa for medical treatment after he was allegedly abducted and tortured for a week. It was the latest salvo in a controversial case after police refused to comply with an earlier court order allowing Dr. Peter Magombe to leave the country. It was unclear whether police would allow him to go. Unconfirmed reports today say the doctor was smuggled from the hospital where he has been treated since he was released by his captors. He is a key figure in the efforts by Zimbabwe's doctors to get a pay raise to compensate for the inflation and currency issues that are increasing the cost of living by the day. Reporter Kuzai Zenawashi has more details.
Yesterday was a long day in the courts in Harare. Lawyer Alec Muchadehama, with the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, briefed the media on the developments from the High Court.
There were two applications in court. One was by the state, in terms of which they sought to set aside an earlier judgment given by Justice Zhou, where he had interdicted the police from interfering with Dr. Magombe's movement to South Africa. So that application by the state was dismissed with cause by the judge president.
He sheds more light on the other court application.
And then there was yet another application which we had made for habeas corpus, where we were saying the police must be ordered to release Dr. Magombe so that they do not continue to detain him unlawfully. That application has been granted, and the police have been ordered to release Dr. Peter Magombe forthwith.
Muchadehama said he didn't see any grounds for the police to appeal the decision by the courts. Human rights groups and the U.S. Embassy have called for the government to strongly pursue the roughly 50 abductions of labor activists and civil leaders this year. No arrests have been made. The government has denied accusations that it is using the kidnappings as an intimidation tactic. For VOA, this is Kuzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And in more news from Harare, the late president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, will be buried at his rural home in Mashonaland, West Province, instead of the Heroes Acre National Shrine in Harare. The burial has been a contentious issue between the government and Mugabe's family for the last 3 weeks. The family had said he could be buried at Heroes Acre, as the government wanted, with a large mausoleum to be constructed there. Now, the government says it will go with the wishes of the family. The burial could be held as early as this weekend in a private ceremony. Mugabe died September 6th while being treated for cancer in Singapore. He was 95. Mugabe was ousted from power in 2017 after 37 years in power. Once celebrated as a revolutionary hero, he also oversaw the country's economic plunge amid allegations of widespread corruption and repression of opponents. A report submitted to the United Nations Human Rights Council urges Sudan's transitional government to adopt a human rights-based approach in its pursuit of economic development and stability for the long-suffering country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
This is the first report by the UN independent expert on Sudan that looks at the human rights situation since protests erupted late last year, leading to the overthrow of longtime President Omar al-Bashir in April. Aristide Nononsi commends the Sudanese military and opposition for signing an agreement on the transfer of power to civilian rule. He says that is a critical step to delivering peace and security for the Sudanese people. Nononsi says the pursuit of human rights is key to overcoming the profound economic crisis, poverty, and inequalities in Sudan. The constitutional declaration signed by the parties envisages the formation of independent commissions to investigate recent and past violations. Nononsi says those bodies must be independent and impartial and must carry out their investigations promptly.
Lessons learned from other countries have shown that investigative commissions can contribute to transitional societies, such as the Sudanese society, in assessing truth about human rights violation, ensuring accountability, serving justice, and achieving guarantee of non-recurrence or non-repetition.
Nononsi says accountability is a critical element to combating violence and preventing a recurrence of violations in the future. Sudan's Minister of Justice, Nasreddin Abdulbari, says he has taken note of the independent expert's observations. He says his government is taking measures to address shortcomings and deficiencies in Sudan's human rights system.
The Prime Minister has issued a decision establishing a national independent commission. As you have mentioned, this commission will investigate the violations and abuses committed against demonstrators since the onset of protests against the former regime until the brutal riot in June on a pro-change, pro-democracy sit-in.
Abdulbari says his government has taken other significant steps. To ensure women's participation, he says four women have been appointed as ministers, and women will compose at least 40% of the Legislative Council. He says significant steps are being taken to end restrictions on the rights of freedom of expression, organization, and peaceful assembly. He says the state of emergency will be abolished, and political detainees are being released. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Egyptian authorities have arrested a number of liberal opposition figures, and police are being deployed to all public squares where protesters had gathered last week in anticipation of more protests tomorrow. Self-exiled military contractor Mohammed Ali accused the Egyptian president and some army officers of corruption has called for more demonstrations. Demonstrations have been banned since Sisi took office in 2014, unless protesters get approval from the Ministry of Interior. Egyptians who participated in last week's protests broke the ban. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Michelle Dunn, director of Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, about the protest movement in Egypt.
It's difficult to know right now whether there will be more protests in Egypt this week, but I think that we have seen the Egyptian public turning a corner where opposition to the way that President Sisi is running the country has risen and come to the surface, and I think there will be more protests in Egypt soon. Maybe this week, maybe not, maybe in the weeks and months to come.
New reports said President Sisi ordered heavy security deployment to prevent protests, and security forces arrested over 1,000 Egyptians, including liberal professors and politicians. Is that the best approach to respond to rising grievances over economic austerity and allegations of official corruption?
Clearly, the Egyptian regime is nervous about larger protests than took place last week. And also, they seem to be nervous that political opposition leaders would be able to connect with public grievances and actually shape them into a coherent public demand for change. So that is what they are trying to prevent. I wish that we would see President Sisi responding to public dissatisfaction with corruption, with economic hardship, with the military grip on the economy. But unfortunately, so far we've seen no evidence that he is likely to make any meaningful concessions.
President Sisi blamed political Islam for the protests in Egypt, and President Trump downplayed the impact of these demonstrations, saying they happen everywhere. What do you make of that?
It wasn't clear to me whether President Trump was briefed on the protests in Egypt before his meeting with President Sisi. It took tremendous courage for Egyptians to go out in the streets and protest. But unfortunately, the news reports about the size and the fact that those protests took place in many different places hadn't really reached the United States before that Trump-Sisi meeting. So I'm not sure that President Trump really had the information about what has happened. Unfortunately, what President Trump said, downplaying the importance of the protest, suggested that the United States would be in favor of any crackdown on protests. I hope that impression will be corrected by U.S. officials in the executive branch and in the legislature, because the United States has stood for the right of peaceful protest all over the world, and that includes in the Trump administration. They have made statements very clearly about the right of peaceful protest in Russia, in Hong Kong, in Sudan, in Iran, and they should do the same thing regarding Egypt.
Egypt blocked BBC and the American Al Hurra TV over their coverage of the demonstrations, and the State Information Service in Egypt called on international media outlets not to exaggerate events in Egypt. What's your take on that?
Well, controlling information space has been one of the Egyptian regime's most important tools. They have put nearly all independent news outlets out of business and have put a great deal of pressure on international as well as local media to report only what government officials say. So clearly what they don't want Egyptians to see that people are protesting all over the country. A couple of days after the protests, the information came out, there were protests in 14 provinces. That's a lot in Egypt, even if they were small. The fact that they were that widespread is significant. That's what the Egyptian government doesn't want its citizens to know, because it doesn't want them to be encouraged to go out and join protests.
That was Michelle Dunn at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. 18 past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. A delegation from the DRC has been holding bilateral talks with the Rwanda Demobilization Commission on accelerating joint efforts to eradicate rebel forces operating in the DRC. They include the FDLR group, made up largely of those who killed Tutsi and moderate Hutus in Rwanda's genocide over 15 years ago. The meeting comes just after the death of FDLR leader Sylvester Mudakumora, who was killed last week by DRC forces. Eugene Uimana has more details from Kigali.
The men in the room are discussing ways of permanently disarming over 100 rebels operating in the forest of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Among the deadly group is the FDLR, whose members fled Rwanda after committing genocide mainly against Tutsi in 1994. Last week, DRC forces killed Lieutenant General Mudachuma Sylvestre, the leader of FDLR. For Rwanda, this was an important goal. Selafine Mukantabana is the chairperson of Rwanda Demobilization Commission. She says his death encourages us. We have seen that with the DRC. those militants who are reluctant to obey our calls for peace can still be punished in other ways. The success of the new initiatives may lie with the growing cooperation between Rwanda and DRC, in particular new initiatives by DRC's President Felix Tshisekedi. Clovis Munire is the coordinator of DRC's Demobilization Commission. He says Felix Tshisekedi has a vision. The rebels concern us all. We have been living with them for more than 25 years. We know how much we miss our peaceful country. So we must fight them together. Hopes are high that Rwanda and DRC can defeat the rebels. President Paul Kagame has pledged military support.
We will rejoin yesterday. So we have no, we've been waiting. And I am glad that we have a person there saying he wants to work with the neighbors to get rid of this problem. Because this problem has been there for too long. And it affects the Congo, it affects the neighbors, it affects all of us. So there is no point in sitting with that problem or allowing that problem to stand in the way of the progress we should be making.
The DRC counts over 100 rebel groups operating in its forest. The Rwandan government so far has received and mobilized 12,000 former militants. However, some rebel groups are still operating to destabilize Congo. The World Health Organization says there have been 130 attacks on health facilities between January and mid-May 2019, resulting in 4 deaths and injuring 38. The assaults may have also contributed to the spread of Ebola. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Today is World Contraception Day, a global campaign focused on improving awareness among young people on making informed choices on sexual and reproductive health. In Kenya, an international medical charity has launched an online campaign to demand action in addressing the East African nation's teenage pregnancy crisis. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
AMREF Health Africa, an international non-profit medical organization, launched the online campaign dubbed Sauti Sasa, Swahili for Voice Now, to coincide with World Contraception Day. This year's theme is It's Your Life, It's Your Responsibility. Sylvia Wamugi is a deputy director of advocacy, communications and strategic partnerships for Youth in Action, AMREF Health Africa.
The Sauti Sasa campaign is specifically launching on World Contraceptive Day because World Contraception Day represents issues of access. We are faced with huge challenges of even accessing contraception for adolescents. We are actually talking about a huge spike to 500,000 teenage pregnancies amongst adolescents. So we're looking at adolescents aged between 10 to 19 years. And yet we are not seeing a lot of government action or even a lot of action by society as a whole.
She says the youth-led movement aims at engaging young people to drive conversation with a call for accelerated action by all. In Kenya, teenage pregnancies are on the rise. According to a recent report by the United Nations Population Fund, more than 350,000 adolescent girls aged 10 and 19 years became pregnant between July 2016 and June 2017. Projections put this year's total at 500,000. Mary Wanjiku is a teen mom who is taking part in the Sauti Sasa online campaign.
I gave birth at 17, so it means I conceived around 16. I got my baby 3 months to my 17th birthday, but I had finished my form 4. I was a normal kid growing up in a slum, like just the others, but I used to play more with the boys. So I didn't have any information when it came to me being a woman. So when I had sex, my first time having sex is when I got pregnant.
Wamugi says rise in current teenage pregnancy shows that adolescent girls need to have the right information to make the right choices about their sexual responsibility and health rights.
We are calling for young people to join the platform, the sautisasa.org platform. Go to www.sautisasa.org to register their solutions. So we are actually asking them to write down solutions on teenage pregnancies that they'd want to propose. The main aim is to have the president actually take action, because we know very well when a politician speaks up about something, then we see some level of change.
She says the policies adopted by U.S. President Trump's administration have affected sexual and reproductive health.
There's a report that was recently released on how the gag rule and how the stringent policies on contraceptives and access to contraceptives for young people and society at large have affected, and even have affected, the U.S. in itself in terms of how sexual and reproductive health issues are being dealt with. So I would say that these are actually policies that are not really helping in terms of dealing with teenage pregnancies.
World Contraception Day takes place on September 26th every year. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Next week, Cameroon's government will host what it calls a national dialogue on the separatist crisis in its northwest and southwest regions. However, U.S. and Europe-based separatist leaders invited to the talks say they will not take part in any dialogue unless it is held outside Cameroon with non-Cameroonians as mediators. The government has stated it will not accept a foreign mediator. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has more on the standoff from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
The week-long dialogue on the separatist crisis is due to begin Monday in Yaoundé. The government says it has invited more than 1,000 people, including lawmakers, clergy, teachers and civil society activists. However, none of the U.S. and Europe-based separatist leaders contacted by VOA said they will attend the talks. Among those turning down the invitation is Eric Tato, who lives in the United States. He says he will not attend because he and fellow separatists based in the diaspora are wanted in Cameroon on charges of secession and terrorism. Those are the same charges for which separatist leaders Ayuk Tabe Julius and 10 collaborators were arrested and sentenced to life in prison by a Yaoundé military tribunal. Tato says Cameroon should free Julius and the other leaders as a sign they are truly ready for dialogue.
I have told them categorically clear, let them release all detainees and then start discussing with them. And then from there we'll know if the president of Cameroon is serious to have dialogue or not.
Fighting in northwest and southwest Cameroon has claimed more than 2,000 lives since hostilities broke out 2 years ago. English-speaking armed groups in those regions want to break away from the rest of Cameroon and its French-speaking majority. Some separatists have said on social media they want the dialogue to take place either in Switzerland or Ivory Coast, under the supervision of world powers like the US, Germany and Britain, and in the presence of the United Nations. George Ewane, spokesperson of the National Dialogue, says Cameroon's President Paul Biya has ruled out the possibility of inviting a foreign mediator. Some nations that have offered to mediate, he says, have not stopped Cameroonians in the diaspora from financially sponsoring violence back home.
Some make the propositions in good faith, but we also know that others don't do that exactly in good faith. Now, let me ask a question. Are Cameroonians really unable to solve their own problems to the extent of seeking a foreign mediation? The answer is an emphatic no. International mediation is not necessary.
Ewane did not name the countries he was referring to, but last July, the Swiss ambassador to Cameroon, Pietro Lazzeri, announced his country was helping the Cameroon's government negotiate with the rebels. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyiswuhib in Washington.
voiceofafrica.com.
On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
voaafrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.